Call the Coach. Sex, love. Carol the Coach. Sex, love, and relationships. We talk about it here.
Carol the Coach. Compassion with contemporary relevance.
I am a psychotherapist. I can be your personal life coach, and I can help you with your issues. There are no problems too small or too big. You can talk about anything.
Speaker, columnist, radio TV host, and commentator. Carol the Coach brings messages of wellness and empowerment within reach of everyday people every day.
Almost 5 years ago, I lost my soulmate in an accident. He was killed in a plane crash. Life just, for me, has seemed to stop.
There are groups all over the city. I mean, I teach one. It is a specific way to start thinking so that you shift how you see the world, which then shifts your energy, and then you feel better, and you actually see things differently.
Carol the Coach. Always available to at carolthecoach.com.
And welcome to Your Best Life. This is Carol the Coach. And again, I am so happy that you are here with me learning some life skills that are going to make your life a lot better. And it can be tough when you're trying out some new skills that you know deep down in your heart you are supposed to be practicing, but you're afraid that you might be hurting the other person's feelings. You don't want to offend anybody. You don't want to make waves. You hate conflict. You avoid it at all costs. And therefore, you cannot be your authentic self. And when you can't be your authentic self, you end up being a people pleaser and doing for others. And that doesn't do you any good. And it really doesn't do the other person any good. So tonight, we're going to be talking about codependency. What is that? If you've been in the mental health field, you know that is when you give up your identity for someone else and you're always working on their issues. You're either assisting them in creating the life that they want or you're covering for them. You know, codependency came from Melody Beatty, who did Codependent No More, and she wrote about the partners of alcoholics and what they do to stay in denial, enable their partners, and virtually live through their partner's life as opposed to their own. So let me just check in with you for a second. Do you find that you seem to give in almost every relationship that you engage in? You know, if you have a husband or wife, are you chronically giving to them? Do you put your kids' needs before your own? Are you the person that calls and checks in with your friends to make sure that they're not mad at you and you check in to see how they're doing and then you realize that, hey, they haven't asked one thing about your life. They haven't checked in with you and they certainly haven't checked in with feelings. You know, a true codependent really doesn't know how to talk, trust, or feel. So tonight, we're going to be talking about how do you break some of those old habits? What are some new behaviors that you actually know that you need to apply to your life? And maybe it's been difficult, and that's why you're listening to this show. And we're going to be interviewing somebody who I happen to know very well. She is a woman who has worked on codependency like no other. Truly, she has attended support groups to keep her in check. She's read the material. She's read the books. And so I asked her if she'd be on the show and if she would talk about her struggles, her challenges, and, of course, her progress and growth, because this is the wonderful thing about codependency. If you invest in not enabling somebody else and you practice these new skills, not only do you become better, but so does your partner, your kids, your coworkers, your neighbors, whoever you have a codependent relationship with. Now, I'm not saying it's easy, and I'm not saying that they don't struggle to some degree. But clearly, it helps them to become more independent or interdependent, and it allows them an opportunity to master some things that perhaps you've been doing for them. You know, I'm a big believer in the motto, when you help, you hurt. Now, that doesn't mean you can't give somebody a hand up and you can't give to them when they're in need. I'm not talking about occasionally being there for somebody else. But if you find yourself doing that 24/7, or you find that you have these patterns where you do that with everybody, then more than likely you suffer from the disease of codependency. Just as an alcoholic struggles with alcoholism, a sex addict struggles with sexual addiction, a drug addict struggles with addiction, you too struggle with finding your real self, with setting boundaries, creating limits, and learning how to practice the art of saying no. You know, women in particular have trouble saying no and setting boundaries. They inherently tend to rescue others. So if you're one of those people, if you chronically put others' needs before your own and you have difficulty even knowing what your needs are, again, this show is exactly for you. So get out your Carol the Coach manual so that you can live your best life. We're going to be writing some things down. I hope that you've written down the number 1-760-683-2646, because that is the number that you're going to need to call in if you have any questions during this show. Again, that number is 760-683-2646. And, you know, I would encourage you to feel free to call in and get those needs met. You know, when I look at a woman or a man and I say, well, what are your needs? And they give me that, oh, my gosh, they have their deer in the headlights look. I know that probably they don't even have a clue as to what their needs are. So I'm going to ask you to break it down into six categories for tonight. And I'm going to check in with you to see if you're meeting any of those six areas, the needs in any of those. So let's just break it down. And we're going to be talking about this again next week, because it's all about having a semi-healthy balance. You know, if you're a young mom and you have three kids, your life probably is mostly all about the kids. That's what it's supposed to be. And I don't expect for you to be able to attend to your needs first and foremost. That is not developmentally appropriate, and it's not appropriate for the family. But a lot of you are middle-aged or even baby boomers, and the kids are grown, and you have taken on the responsibility of caring for the grandkids. You know, it wasn't enough that you raised your own family. Now you're doing it with your kids' kids. And you have every right to really spend time getting to know yourself. Now, those six needs are the emotional needs, the intellectual needs, the social needs, the physical needs, the spiritual needs, and the purposeful needs. That was pretty good. I just did that off the top of my head. I don't have any cheat sheets here, at least not in terms of those needs. So let's go over one more time. There are six basic needs. And I want you to think about what you do to meet each one of those pieces of the pie that make up that entire circle. Again, there's social, emotional, physical, intellectual, spiritual, and purposeful. You know, we all need to have a purpose in our life. Maybe that is being a full-time student. Maybe that is being the mother of four. Maybe that is being the provider in your family. Maybe that is a Bible school or Sunday school. You know, it can be anything, but it really has to give you that sense of meaning. And when you've met that purpose, then you know that, you know, you have the right fit. Now, if your purpose is rescuing somebody else, if you have a kid who is on drugs, who's been arrested a couple of times, who has really consumed your every waking hour, you're going to need to learn the boundary of detaching with love. If you have a spouse who drinks every night when he or she comes home, and, you know, maybe they don't get drunk, but they numb out. They have nothing to give. They don't really contribute much at night. Maybe you're lucky enough to have them cook a meal or take out the trash. But there's no intimacy. There's no emotional connection. There's no good communication. Well, if that is the case, you know, you have to decide, how are you going to handle that? And when you're codependent, it's hard to assert yourself. Or maybe you have asserted yourself and it just doesn't seem to have gone anywhere. Maybe you bitched and moaned and cried and screamed and yelled and ranted and raged, and it hasn't resulted in you getting those needs met. Well, guess what? If that person, if your partner can't meet those needs, if your kid is not developmentally in a place to shift their behavior, if your boss is such a rageaholic that he or she cannot validate who you are and talk to you in a civil manner, then you got to figure out, what are you going to do about it? And that's why it's so important to know your needs. Now, maybe you're stuck in a dead-end job and you can't leave. Maybe you've been putting in your resume. Maybe nobody's responding. Well, then that's the time to bump up another one of those six pieces of the pie. In other words, maybe that's when you increase your exercise so that you physically take control of your body, you get away from the situation, you create some good mental health so that you're better able to cope with a rageaholic boss, and you physically feel better. You know, you're not sluggish, you're not overweight, your muscles are toned, and, you know, you've put enough oxygen into your body. Okay, so that doesn't solve the rageaholic boss, but it does take care of who you are a little bit better than if you ignore that need. And I'm a big believer in social support. And if you've got codependency, well, there are these fabulous groups, Codependence Anonymous, that you can go to, and they're absolutely free. They ask for a donation. Most people give a buck, and that pays for the literature that goes to the new newbies that come to the group. And what you clearly learn is, you know, how do you stay in your own life and get out of the lives of others? How do you stop giving so much when your whole life has been invested in somebody else? So, you know, I can't say enough for that social group. And so when I'm talking to people and they say, I don't have any friends. My coworkers aren't my friends. My neighbors are remote. They just don't connect. Then I say, well, get your butt to a group, because, you know, there's Al-Anon, there's Narnon, there's Codependence Anonymous, there's COSA, which is a support group for partners of sex addicts. And, you know, there's just plenty of places you can go to get your support. So you can never say, I don't have an option, because you know what? You always have choices. And working on codependency means that you attend to what those choices are. And developing that good sense of self may mean that you need to start intellectually stimulating yourself. Now, you know, we tell senior citizens, work crossword puzzles, do Sudoku. And certainly there are people that nonstop get on their computers and play their games most of the night. But I'm talking about challenging yourself by doing something that's really healthy, that's stimulating, and makes you feel like you're learning something. And if you're listening to my voice and you're going, my gosh, I am way too tired to take on another thing, then perhaps we need to start with that physical need. And maybe you need to start with the basics, getting a good amount of sleep and taking your vitamins and taking naps during the weekend. You can't catch up on sleep, but clearly what you can do is increase the amount of sleep you get so you're not so exhausted. What I do know to be true, though, is that if you are depressed, then clearly what ends up happening is that you have no energy. You are lethargic. You clearly have difficulty. So I want you to be thinking about that. After the break, we're going to be talking to our guest, and she's going to be talking about what she did to break the chains of codependency.
Carol the Coach, sex, love, and relationships. We talk about it here.
Carol the Coach, compassion with contemporary relevance.
I am a psychotherapist.
Well, welcome to the show. Glad you called in. How you doing?
I'm well, thank you.
And you know, you really are the queen of working through codependency. So, you know, I wondered if you would be willing to share with the audience what you have done to kind of break those chains and take better care of yourself.
Absolutely. This being codependency is something that I have been working on for the last, I would say, 3.5 years, maybe four. I came to understand that I had a problem because of something that was going on in my marriage. I, at that time, figured, as most codependents do early on in their journey, that my problems would all be fixed if my husband would just do everything that I wanted him to do. As I started to read, I started with the anthem of codependence, Codependent No More by Melody Beattie, and as I started to understand more about codependency and the way that it manifests itself in our lives, I started to have a shift in my thinking. This didn't happen overnight, obviously. It happened, I would say, over the course of probably 6 months to a year, where I began to own the fact that the problems that I was suffering in my marriage and in my own life were not ones that I could put at anybody else's feet. I had to come to an understanding that the reason that I wasn't fulfilled and happy was because I wasn't taking care of myself the way I needed to in order to live my best life.
So you said that when you first started this journey, you were at a place where you thought, if my husband were only different, our lives would be happier.
Exactly.
And then as you began to read the books and get more information, you recognized that you had to find the happiness within yourself regardless of what he did.
That's right. That's right. And that goes back to your comments before about detaching with love, and that was one of the skills that I had to learn first and foremost in my situation because of how I came into recovery.
Okay, so then he was participating in something that, I mean, it was like drinking or gambling or sexing or something that was interfering in your life.
Right.
Okay, and how did you feel when that was going on? I mean, did it consume you? Did you get depressed and sleep all the time? What were the physical symptoms that told you that you were in trouble?
First of all, psychologically, I was definitely consumed with whatever he was thinking and doing, and I became sort of an investigator, always checking on, you know, what was going on and looking at his emails and trying to understand what was happening with him. And whenever I would even get an inkling that there was maybe something going on, I had severe physical symptoms. I would literally get sick to my stomach. over the time that I was doing all of these things, I experienced a lot of weight loss. I experienced some hair loss. I was very ill all the time, not sleeping, just in a really in a state of high anxiety, and I actually, for the first time in my life, had a panic attack, which was, I think, the panic attack was the moment when I realized that I could not continue in that situation any longer. So it was certainly a very strong physical and emotional response to what was going on.
And you brought up a good point, because there's a lot of therapists out there that say, you know, if your husband's cheating, if he's spending too much money, if he's gambling, if he's drinking, you have every right to check a cell phone or get online and check his emails or, you know, go to his bank account and take a look at that. And so you've got these therapists that say that.
Mm-hmm.
And then you were actually doing some of that.
Yes.
And it was probably creating more anxiety for you.
Absolutely. What I came to understand was that when I was doing all the checking and looking, that my intention was not that I was going to find something and leave, because I was so codependent that my entire understanding of myself was wrapped up in my marriage. I was completely enmeshed, as they say. What I was doing was looking for that information in order to hurt myself and to create drama in the marriage, because creating drama allowed me to get attention. It was something that I could use to have my spouse give me attention, because I could present him with facts and information showing him where he had done wrong. And that cycle continued to play itself out, where I would get hurt and he would feel guilty, and then he would, you know, feel the need to do whatever wrong things he was doing, and that just continued to happen and happen and happen.
And what should I reference you as? What name do you want to go by tonight? Because this
is
an anonymous call.
Right.
So what should I call you?
You can call me Mary.
Okay. So Mary, if I understand you correctly, because you've got the psychological wisdom that you didn't have at the time, but
right.
When you did the discovery, when you became the investigator and you would find information, you would take it to him in a dramatic way because you were hurt and felt betrayed and all that stuff, and then you would create drama, and it would give you some special attention, because I'm sure that there was a lot of shame and blame on his part.
Right.
And so you kept that cycle perpetuated. At least then you got the attention you deserved, even though you probably would have said at that point, I didn't want that attention. I just wanted him to be a caring, loving husband.
Exactly. That's exactly what I said at the time.
Right. But now you realize that because your life was out of control, what you really needed was validation and attention.
Yeah. And I realize now also, having done a lot of work in codependency and having done a lot of work through my 12-step program, that what I was doing was recreating some childhood events for myself where I was looking for drama and looking for attention, because this was something that continued throughout my life. And so understanding that has helped me really break that desire to create dramatic events in order to get attention.
Okay, and so oftentimes in psychology, we do find that if you've had some trauma as a child, then things occur in your life as an adult that reenact that trauma. It may not be the exact same thing, but the same process occurs. So a child who may have been abused sexually, verbally, or physically may get in a relationship where they are abused sexually, physically, or verbally. So you're saying you really felt like there was that connection.
Yes, I do.
Can you share how? What connection there was for you?
When I was young, I was sort of we have a large extended family, and there was many of us cousins that used to be around each other all the time, and I was always sort of the ostracized one. And so when I was young, I was bullied a little bit by my school. Well, I was bullied a lot at school and sort of ostracized a bit by my cousins. And in particular, there was a maternal uncle who really sort of shunned me and would treat me poorly. And I remember acting in sort of getting in trouble by doing crazy things, or, you know, by being bad or by stealing things and creating these dramatic events that would bring everyone's attention onto me. And I think that in particular, when I think about the pattern, I feel that in particular seems a lot like what I was doing when I was being like I wasn't getting any attention in my marriage, and I was being ostracized and sort of not validated by my spouse, that I would do this similar thing, you know, do this quote-unquote bad thing by searching through his emails or his phone or whatever, and then getting this dramatic attention again.
Well, that makes sense. And so what we know about kids and parenting is that if a child isn't getting attention, negative attention is better than no attention. And so here you were feeling invisible or ostracized from the rest of the group, and when you acted out, you at least got everybody to notice you and pay attention to you, even if one would have looked at that and said, well, why would you want that? There was that psychological need to be noticed. And then you did the same thing in your marriage when your husband appeared to be out of control with his behavior, and then you could point that out, that his blame and shame would focus on you, and you would keep that cycle going.
Right.
And so, you know, you said that you read Codependent No More by Melody Beattie, and really that is the Bible of codependency. Mm-hmm. She is the guru of codependency, although there are a lot of other great books that deal with breaking the cycle of codependency or setting healthy boundaries. Can you think of any other books that you've read that have been helpful to you?
Yeah, definitely. When you speak of boundaries, one of the things that I find in my 12-step groups and in my 12-step work, and which is very hard for people new to recovery to understand, is the idea of a boundary. What is a boundary? How do I set one? How do I enforce it? And it was something I struggled with for a long time, but I read, there's two, Boundaries, the name of the book, and also Boundaries in Marriage by Cloud and Townsend.
Mm-hmm.
And both of those are exceptionally well written. They really very clearly lay out what boundaries are, how to enforce them, what is the psychological purpose and need for a boundary. So I really, really do like that book. Another book that I like, also by Melody Beattie, is called The Grief Club. And the reason I like that book is that it helps, it helped me understand the things in my life that I felt that I had lost or that I needed to grieve, the loss of innocence, the loss of my dreams of what I thought my marriage was going to be like, the loss of any number of things, and how to go about understanding that grief so that you can move past it and move past the resentment and shame and guilt. The other and last one there's two more probably, Homecoming by John Bradshaw, which is a book that helps people understand how to put their childhood into perspective as a part of their entire existence, to see how maybe things that happened in your childhood might have contributed to your codependent or addictive behaviors as an adult. And finally, these are actually books by a Buddhist monk, but his name is Thich Nhat Hanh, and he does a series of books. The one that I like in particular is Answers from the Heart. And the reason I like it is because it really teaches the idea of mindfulness, not even so much the religious or spiritual aspect as much as understanding that everything we do requires our full attention. And when we don't give our full attention in any moment, that's when, especially for those of us who are codependent and who rely on these codependent patterns, that when you don't really pay attention to what you're doing, it's easy to fall back into some of those old behaviors because they're so well ingrained. So that idea of just being really purposeful and mindful, I'm not saying I do it well 100% of the time, but certainly 70 or 80% today is 70 or 80% better than where I was a few years ago.
Well, yeah, and as you were talking, I was thinking about how so oftentimes there is a whole theoretical belief for therapists, and especially marital therapists, that we pick our partners based on our childhood wounds. And so it's a chance to get the wound righted, you know, to fix it, to recover from it, to create what we need as adults that we didn't get as kids. And so one might suspect that you actually picked your husband, not knowing he had those problems consciously, because of your childhood, and that it's been an opportunity. Obviously, anybody who's listening to you speak can see that you have studied diligently this concept, and you've really worked hard at breaking those chains, and that the issues he had with you and you with him, you took that situation, and instead of feeling like you crumbled, you were able to gain some strength and learn some things, and your marriage is probably much better off, let alone you.
Absolutely. In both of those things are dramatically, dramatically improved. In fact, tomorrow we'll be celebrating our 10-year wedding anniversary, and a few years ago I would have told you that that day was never going to come. So it really, for our marriage, it has been a really fantastic thing. But more than that, and what in my program, the one thing that I really strongly adhere to is that I make my recovery process 100% about me. I never blame anything that happens to me or in my life or that has happened on my spouse, because I feel that for me, taking 100% ownership of where I have gotten is what I need in order to live a healthy and fulfilled life.
So can you give us, I know this is putting you on the spot, but can you give us just an example of something that's occurred in your life just recently where you had to say, okay, I may feel like I'm pissed at him or mad at her or hurt, but then you reeled it back in and said, no, I'm 100% accountable. This is how I feel, and this is how I'm going to approach things.
Yeah, it's about a year old now, but this is an example that really showed me that I have really gotten somewhere. I was actually throwing a bridal shower for my sister-in-law, and because of some family events and some sickness and illness that was going on, we had to change the date. In the changing of the date, we, everybody didn't get the information of the new date and time, and so there was a little bit of confusion. But at the end of the day, on the day of the bridal shower, everybody had gotten all the information they needed and everybody had arrived. As I was running around that day, it was a huge event. We had about 75 women there. As I was running around, you know, doing the organization and keeping things going, I overheard my sister-in-law, not the one I was throwing the shower for, but another woman, complaining about not having good information and, you know, that everything seemed haphazard with the date changing. And I felt really horribly about that. And I know that in the past I would have crumbled. That would have ruined my entire day, and I would have not known how to continue. Not only not known how to continue, but I would never have said anything to her about it. I would have completely internalized her rejection and criticism of me and used it to shame and blame and hurt myself. Instead, I said, you know, there were some mistakes. I didn't maybe follow up as quickly as I needed to, and I could have done this a little sooner, and I 100% owned that that definitely could have been done better. But what I did do was I walked up to her and I said, I heard you talking, and it sounds like you were upset about the way the communication went for the bridal shower date, And I wanted to know if you want to talk about it, because I think it's better if you talk about it with me than with other people. She was she was extremely chagrined. She was embarrassed. She was upset that I had hurt her, and she was very ashamed at being called out, frankly. And what I felt
but
in that moment
But you didn't really
was,
call her out, though. I mean, you definitely addressed the issue, but you weren't critical of her. You just basically shared a preference.
Right.
I would like for you to talk to me as opposed to talking to others.
Right.
Yeah,
and
so then what happened?
Well, she was very apologetic. She apologized profusely. She said, "I'm really sorry. I didn't mean to do that. I should have talked to you." And I said, one of the things that really bothered me was she was talking about me to my very younger nieces, which seemed very disrespectful to me, but I just said to her, you know, we're both adult women, and I certainly never meant to disclude you or to hurt you in any way, and so please know that this was a mistake, and I want you to know that I feel hurt by what I saw going on. So that was the end of that, and she, for the rest of the day, was just very apologetic to me, but that moment said to me that I was capable, and this is something that I heard from my therapist, that we teach people how to treat us. And I think about that all the time, because it really is true. When we let people know where we end and they begin, we have a boundary of safety.
Well, yeah, and you know, I don't know if you heard me earlier say that people that are codependent usually grew up in families where they were either invisible or the other extreme occurred. They took care of everybody and did everything, and they were surrogate parents. And so oftentimes if you're invisible, you don't get validated, and so you really don't know who you are. You don't know who to trust, what to say, or how to feel. Or if you're flying by the seat of your pants and you're being a surrogate parent to everybody, then you're too busy taking care of others to know who you are. And with your cousin, you were able to share your feelings, assert yourself, be accountable and say, yeah, maybe this didn't go off as well as I would have liked it to. However, let's you and I talk about it. And that was really good emotional maturity on your part. I'm glad you were able to see what progress that you have made. Now, do you think you had difficulty talking, trusting, and feeling as a kid?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Those, whenever I talked, I don't even know how to say this in a way which makes sense to people, but I was a fantastical liar. I would make things up because I was so starved for somebody to pay attention to me that I would tell people anything that I thought they wanted to hear. Trusting, I think my sense of trust was, I don't even know that I had a sense of trust because I gave it to everyone. I was so starved for some kind of attention and affection that I incorrectly trusted anyone that came in my path. And so in terms of those things, it was absolutely skewed, and I had no sense of how to do any of those things correctly.
Okay, and so you're saying that through the 12-step program and your therapy and your reading, you began to not only learn about boundaries and limits and assertiveness, but you also figured out how to trust people, how to talk, and certainly how to feel.
Absolutely. One of the promises of the program, I'm sorry,
No, I was going to say that I want you to talk a little bit about the program. So go ahead. You said one of the promises is?
One of the promises is that as we learn to heal in this program, that we learn to talk to our family in a way which is safe for us and respectful of them. And that is definitely one of the areas that I really feel that I have seen a great improvement. I mean, there are 12 promises, and I would say that in large part they have all come true in my life. But this program, just going back to the very beginning, is a program that requires us to take a really hard look at our own lives and our own behaviors in order to understand in a non-shaming way where and how we developed these characteristics or patterns of behavior that keep us from being as happy as we really want to be. The 12 steps can sometimes be difficult for people because they feel that there's some kind of religious undertone, and there certainly can be. I myself am not a Christian. However, I feel that this program, if you are open to it and just allow the principles of the program to come into your life, that you can have a tremendous transformation by applying the principles of, you know, just letting go of the things that hold you back. There are 12 steps, why it's called a 12-step program, and there are meetings. Currently we have 3 meetings in town, starting a new one on September 3rd. But the program is one that if people are willing to give some time and diligent work to, it really can change their lives.
Well, and you're somebody that I typically use to hook up with people who may be afraid of going to a program, because what I get so often, both in my own groups that I run or in referencing 12-step groups, I get people that say, oh, I'm not a group person. I don't want to go and talk to other people. It seems really scary. And they don't even really know what they would be getting into, but the thought of being with other people and either sharing or listening feels very frightful. So sometimes we can hook a person up with another person who's been in the program, because you've been in your 12-step program for how long?
I started 12-step about 2.5 years ago.
So we can sometimes hook people up with people that have, you know, that know the program, and it takes some of the edge off of walking into a new situation and not knowing anybody. But that really is the courage that most people have to have, is they have to get themselves to their first meeting. And you heard me say that it's free. But
right.
When you go there, what can somebody expect in a 12-step program in Codependence Anonymous?
You can expect that you will not be required to speak. You won't be required to make any kind of a statement about yourself, to tell any of your story. You are welcome to come and sit and listen as long as you like, whether it's a couple weeks, a couple months, a couple years. You actually never have to speak. And you can take a benefit from the learnings that you hear from the group. The other thing that you can expect is a very warm welcome. Certainly there will be people that will greet you, but no one in a codependent meeting will pressure you to, even on a one-on-one basis, talk about why you're there, unless you would like to do that. Sometimes we have new people come and they might hear something that one of the group members has said, and so after the meeting they might want to talk to someone, and so generally several of us will stay a little bit late after a meeting in order to allow newcomers to talk if they would like to. We understand that coming to a 12-step meeting requires an enormous amount of courage and an enormous amount of bravery, because we are so afraid as codependents to allow anyone into our lives or to have anyone solve our problems, because we, like you said previously, we're so busy solving everybody else's. So there is a strong culture of just wanting to be present for other people, but also allowing other people, especially new people, to have the space that they need to tell their stories or to share when they are comfortable.
Yeah, and you know, sometimes when I've made referrals, Mary, and I've made them to Al-Anon, Alcoholics Anonymous, for the loved one of somebody who has a drinking problem, or Narnon, which is for people that, you know, use drugs, the person will come back to me and they'll be really mad and they'll say, I cannot believe you sent me to that group. You know, you got a bunch of people that are putting up with their alcoholic partners. And I didn't want to hear that. I wanted somebody to tell me how I could make this better. And so, truly, any of these 12-step groups, one of the number one principles, although it's not a step, but it is a principle, is that you don't really focus on what the other person is doing. You focus on yourself. And so that's why, obviously, if you're going to AA, if you're going to Al-Anon because your husband or wife has a drinking problem, you don't focus on how to fix them. You focus on how to feel better.
Right.
So there are 12 steps in a 12-step meeting, and you brought up the religious piece because the first couple of steps really do have to do with accepting that, you know, your life's unmanageable and something greater than yourself has to restore you to sanity. True?
That is. Those are the first two steps.
And then after that, you really take a look at your own self, your own wounds, your own flaws, your own strengths, and you get to talk with somebody about those whenever you feel ready. And like you said, some people, that may be years, and other people, they can fly through the program, and they may want to get right into the meat of that.
Right.
And then there are times when you realize that you've actually hurt people by trying to help them. Would you agree with that?
Absolutely.
And so you may be making some amends to some people or at least to your own sponsor so that you get some of those wounds out and you get to kind of heal from that. Would you agree with that?
I would.
Now, am I missing any other steps besides, of course, the service piece, which is so important that you know, once you go through the program, you get to help others. And obviously, you've worked through the steps, right? Have you worked through all 12?
I have worked through all 12.
Mm-hmm. So is there another chunk that I'm missing for anybody who is looking at, you know, what do they need to do? What can they expect if they go to one of these groups?
The one step that I continue to find very important in my life, obviously step 12 is the step that requires us to continue in the program and to be of service to other people. That is a very important step to me. But the other one that's important to me is, there's two more. Step 10, which requires us sort of every day to take a look at our own behaviors during the day. It's called taking a personal inventory and to, as we realize that we've harmed another person or that we've harmed ourselves, to make that acknowledgement and then to either apologize if we need to or to do something to correct that. And sometimes, like I say, that can be to ourselves. We may have fallen back into a codependent pattern or done something in a way that harmed ourselves that we need to also be aware of. And that is an important check for me to make sure that I'm continuing to follow my path, not only to be the kind of person that I want to be, but also to know that I'm not falling back into all old patterns and behaviors. Finally, the one that I also really value and treasure every day of my life is the idea of taking time for prayer and meditation. As I said, I'm not Christian. I do have a very strong spiritual sense of self, and so meditation and the idea of maybe not prayer, but just having this intention for myself is really important because it keeps me grounded and centered. And as I mentioned before, it keeps me very, very mindful of the things that I'm doing and how I'm doing them.
Well, and even though you're not Christian, you do believe in a power greater than yourself that
Absolutely.
Can help you through this process so that you're never really alone.
No, that's absolutely correct, and I don't want to minimize that idea. I think it's absolutely crucial that as we go through this program, and not crucial, but it's sort of a gift of the program, that as we go through this program, we realize that some of us that have maybe had trouble with religion in the past or have felt harmed by religion, this is something that we see a lot in 12-step groups, that we come to a certain sense of peace and understanding. And we have a new sense of a relationship with a power greater than ourselves, and it is a very beautiful thing to see and to have happen in speaking for myself, in my own life.
Well, I know that everybody's journey is different. And for you, your journey started when you were very young, and you are now a better person because of the supports and the hard work that you have done. If would you end the show by sharing the characteristics that you believe somebody may possess if they are codependent? You know, I kind of opened up the show with talking about things, but from your
sure.
point of view, how would you describe somebody who is codependent?
Somebody who is codependent, and I'm quoting a little bit here from the patterns of codependency, because I truly believe that codependence is sort of a syndrome of different characteristics and behaviors. Not any one of us has all of them, but many of these will show up in our lives. So things like denial, we have difficulty identifying what our feelings are, or we do things like we minimize how we feel, or we say, oh, you know, even if we were hurt by something somebody did, we'll say, oh, you know, it wasn't that bad, even though we might inside be really feeling terrible about it. We consider ourselves completely unselfish. We'll do for others and others, and we'll completely give all of our day, and then at the end of the day we feel completely spent, and our house is a mess, and we're eating Burger King, but we've done all these things, wonderful things for other people. Low self-esteem is certainly something that comes up a lot in codependency. That manifests itself in difficulty making decisions, even when it comes to things like going to restaurants. I remember in my own life, deciding where to go out to eat was, well, where do you want to go? Well, it's okay if I had that this morning. I'll have it again. It's just things like that. We are never good enough. Everything that we think or say or do will never be up to a high enough standard. We're embarrassed when people try to praise us or give us any recognition. We have needs and desires and wants of our own, but are never able to give voice to those things. Some of the other things are that we just don't fundamentally perceive that we ourselves are lovable or worthwhile or deserving of any attention or love. Another group of characteristics would be compliance. Some of these would be that we compromise our own values and our own integrity in order to avoid rejection or in order to avoid somebody else's anger. We will be extremely sensitive to how other people feel, and then when we get the sense that somebody is feeling a certain way, we're kind of like chameleons. We feel the same way. I remember never being able to have a discussion with someone else about any kind of topic, because whatever somebody else felt, I would just automatically agree or take on their position, because I just had no sense of my own position in the world. One that's really big is that we are extremely loyal people, even in a situation where we might be in an unhealthy or unsafe even relationship. We'll continue to stay there believing that we can save another person, or if we just do something a little differently, we can make somebody's life better. We place a higher value on what other people think and feel. We won't give a differing opinion about how we feel. We'll put aside our own hobbies and our own interests in order to do what somebody else wants. You know, for example, I hate action movies, but if somebody else wanted to go see one, I would happily sit through 20 just to have that person's company. And I'd probably pay for them, too. you know, and finally, I think the last one, and one where it can be a little deceiving, are control patterns, because sometimes controlling people can seem very strong and that they have everything together, but these can be people who believe that other people not only need to be taken care of, but they're not even able to take care of themselves. And so we swoop in and say, look, you don't know how to do it right, so let me just take care of your life. Controlling people might attempt to make other people, we convince them about what they think and feel. We become resentful, in fact, when others won't let us help them, and we will offer advice and guidance without being asked. We feel bad when we give advice and guidance and people don't take it. Giving gifts and favors without being asked, or lavishing them on people. This is something that comes up a lot in meetings, where people will spend lots and lots of money on other people in the hopes that spending this money and giving these things to people will create this bond. That definitely is something that comes up a lot. Also,
so, you know, I'm going to be giving an assignment at the end of the show where I'm going to be asking people to think about those six needs and mm-hmm. to come up with at least two ways that they meet each one of the needs. So can I run through them with you just to give them an idea of how it works?
Sure.
Okay. So would you share with us two ways that you meet your physical needs?
I am very conscientious about working out. I didn't always used to be. In fact, I was very overweight, but I now realize that working out gives me a sense of confidence in myself, and I also do a lot of yoga, which could be considered working out, but I consider it sort of a way of meditating,
mm-hmm.
a way of body meditation, and so those are two things that I do to take care of my physical needs.
Okay, and what are two ways that you take care of your social needs?
I make sure that I am not always spending time, not just with my husband, but I have now, which is unusual for me from 4 years ago, I have a wide range of friends, and I stay in touch with them. So the first thing I would do is I stay in touch with my friends. I actively call them. I actively let them know how I'm doing. I actively ask them how they're doing. And the second thing is I make sure that I have time with people apart from my husband, so with my girlfriends, with my Codependence Anonymous friends, with my school friends. I actively harness the power of my social network.
Okay. How do you meet two of your emotional needs?
Emotional needs are definitely ones that can be tricky, but some of the things I do is in situations where things don't go the way I want them to go or that I am having trouble, I continually remind myself that I'm okay and that whatever is going on is something that I can get through and that I can handle it and that I have the tools that I need. So I do a lot of self-talk, a lot of positive self-talk to let myself know that I can handle things. The other thing that I do is I make sure that I live my life in a way which sort of has some integrity. And I that might be weird for emotional needs, but for me it's very closely linked because I know that when I'm doing the right thing, that I don't ever have a reason to feel bad about my actions. And so that's how I sort of link that to emotions.
Well, and that really obviously shows that you've worked through some of the habitual lying that you did as a kid just to be noticed. So if you have a good sense of integrity, you know you're right on target.
Yeah.
What about how do you meet your spiritual needs?
That's another important one for me. I meditate regularly, and I also do a lot of reading of some spiritual books, and I watch, you know, some YouTube videos sometimes if I need to, or I listen to podcasts or things about spiritual matters in order to keep myself engaged and continually thinking about my spiritual self.
Well, that makes sense, and it looks like we're coming close to the end of the show, but Mary, I want to thank you again, and although this program is heard all over, would you share that new meeting and where that's going to be? And how
sure.
people can find out about it.
Sure. Meetings, wherever you are in the world, can be found at www.coda.org. CODA is CODA. www.coda.org. And you can go there and find a meeting. The new meeting that we're starting here in Indianapolis will be on Saturday morning. It will be from 9:30 to 10:30 a.m. at St. Luke's United Methodist Church. That's at 100 West 86th Street. And the room is W125. It's right up front across from the Hope Garden. Again, that's 9:30 to 10:30 a.m. on Saturday mornings in room W125. No need to go through the church. It's right up front across from the Hope Garden. And that meeting will be starting on September 3rd. Anybody is welcome to come. The tradition of Codependence Anonymous is that if you have a desire for healthy and loving relationships, you are welcome to attend a Codependence Anonymous meeting. So,
Thank you, Mary. That is exactly the information we were looking for, and I appreciate you sharing yourself with the listening audience. You've done incredible work, and I know you're an inspiration to others. Thanks so much. Okay.
Thank you.
Okay. And as I say at the end of every show, there will be only one of you at all times. Fearlessly be yourself. See you next week.